Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link from our DW studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Crispin Mwakideu. Coming up, as the world ramps up efforts to stop the Ebola virus in Liberia, this Sierra Leonean activist calls on the world not to forget his country.
I hear a lot of the presenters and the doctors and the CDCs making the plans, and the higher numbers were being allocated to Liberia. And we have similar cases.
South Africa's public protector comes under fire for exposing a corruption scandal involving President Jacob Zuma.
The public protector must get out of the political space, leave us as political parties to fight it out, sort ourselves out.
Don't miss out on that story. Plus, suspected Boko Haram militants attack a college in northern Nigeria. We shall be hearing from our correspondent. Stay tuned.
Top story.
Global response to a global threat. The US President Barack Obama called the Ebola crisis in West Africa a threat to world security as he set out an aggressive plan to combat the virus. Across the Atlantic, the European Union announced an additional €78 million as efforts to stop Ebola intensified. Ismail Alfred Charles is a Sierra Leonean and the program manager of the Healy International Relief Foundation in Freetown. He was invited to address a U.S. congressional meeting on the epidemic. This is what he told them.
I told the U.S. Senate exactly how things are going on. Things like this, the current situation with the economic downturn, the negative situation with family lives, how people are suffering, how the cost of commodities have tripled up, and how number of people, companies are closing down, business are not running anymore, the banks are losing out, and the farmers are dying. And so things are not really working very well. The shape and the circumstance of the health infrastructures are really broken, and the state is overwhelmed with the circumstances in handling the Ebola.
And how did the U.S. senators react to your briefing? How did they take the whole issue?
Well, they reacted very positively. They demonstrated a very strong sense of compassion, and they realized the importance of having a human face to the whole story, because what they've been hiring most times are technical people, technocrats, doctors who talk about the technical languages. But then having somebody from the grassroots, from Sierra Leone, I actually arrived at 2 o'clock in the morning on Monday in America, proposed to testify on Tuesday afternoon. And so it basically brings a human face to the whole situation. And they were very happy to have somebody testifying and talking about the family lines, the realities of how the low-class Sierra Leoneans or West Africans are feeling the pinch of this particular situation.
And was there any commitments that was made by the politicians, you know, giving support, or whether morally or financially or in whatever sense?
Well, yes. There are a couple of commitments. They definitely said it outrightly that they're going to move it to another level. But you know how processes works. You know how state governments works. So they have to move it to a different process. They will do a couple of other things, and then because the committee that sat on the hearing basically is the appropriation committee, which means that that's the committee that determines where the money of the taxpayers goes. So. Essentially, they're supposed to put together resources and say X amount is going to go for X particular things. And so that was, in essence, why we testified in front of them.
A lot of attention currently is being given or focused on Liberia, where obviously the outbreak has hit the hardest. But how does that make you feel as a Sierra Leonean? Do you think you're being sidelined in the fight to cap the spread of the virus?
Candidly, I said it yesterday, even at the Senate. I pleaded that they do not forget Sierra Leone, because by virtue of the history and the background, they have more tied to Liberia. But they were expecting that the British government was going to support Sierra Leone equally. But unfortunately, it has not been that case. So I pleaded at the Senate that they should not forget Sierra Leone. I hear a lot of the presenters and the doctors and the CDCs making the plans, and the higher numbers were being allocated to Liberia. And we have similar cases in Sierra Leone. So it's a situation where we want them to understand that it's not only Liberia, but it's also in Sierra Leone. And of course, definitely Guinea, you know, because once the Ebola has been stopped in one of the countries, it can cross borders again. So it has to be a holistic approach to the whole of West Africa, and so that we eradicate it once and for all.
Sierra Leonean activist Ishmael Alfred Charles in Washington. The World Bank on Wednesday warned of a catastrophic economic impact on countries affected by the Ebola crisis in West Africa. The warning comes ahead of a UN Security Council emergency meeting on Thursday to discuss the Ebola epidemic. Manji Cheto is the vice president of Teneo Intelligence, a risk analysis organization in London. This is what she thinks will come out of the UN meeting.
Well, I mean, like I said, I think you can definitely expect the unexpected. The meeting itself is quite unprecedented, and the decision and the choices that the Security Council has to take is a fairly kind of new mandate for the Security Council. Members have already expressed whether or not they even have the kind of powers to enact, you know, recommendations that would be necessary. And specifically, I mean, the issue that they will be reviewing is whether or not they could ask the member states of the UN, particularly the neighbouring countries in Mano River, for Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone, to lift the travel restrictions that they've imposed, which has made it very difficult to move humanitarian supplies in and out of the three affected countries.
And do you expect the Security Council to work as one on the Ebola crisis, or will there be the usual, you know, geopolitical wrangles and interests to be considered?
Well, I think on this basis, it's very difficult to see how geopolitical interests will, you know, override the decision to address this as a global security threat. However, the concern, like I said, will be more on technicalities. You know, does the UN Security Council have the powers to actually make those recommendations? And also, if it does make those recommendations, can it actually enforce it? Which, or, you know, is a question for the UN Security Council. It has been a question on all matters that it's dealt with. And I don't think that this will be any different.
Now, the international community seems to have finally woken up to the threat posed by the Ebola outbreak. Is there any reason as to why they took so long?
It's a safe assumption to make that a lot of people, a lot of governments were taken completely by surprise with the outbreak and also the scale of it. And so, you know, there were very few governments that had the kind of appropriate response mechanisms to deal with an outbreak of this nature. And so really everyone is kind of learning on the go. And I think that the kind of delay between, you know, when the outbreak was first reported to where we are now, I think that time lapse has mainly been a result of people just really not knowing what to do and how to coordinate efforts in a way that was effective, which admittedly has not been effective.
To what extent is this crisis a global security threat, as President Barack Obama would like us to believe?
I think, you know, the example of Nigeria and even of Senegal, where the outbreak was a direct result of human movement from one border to another, shows that it is a credible threat that you cannot dismiss. I mean, however, the medical community has, you know, said that, you know, any kind of contagion via flights or via border crossings is still quite low. But the fact that it has happened means that it's a risk that you cannot discount, and therefore it definitely should be seen from the perspective of it being a potential global security threat.
And what can you say about the efforts that are being put to contain the virus? I mean, a lot of attention so far seems to be focused on Liberia. Is that a wise strategy?
Again, it's very difficult. Like I said, it's quite an unprecedented crisis, but it's quite clear that, you know, you've got to have efforts kind of equally distributed in the three countries, particularly because the main reason why we've had those three countries struggling to contain the outbreak is because they share very kind of lengthy borders. As long as one country remains vulnerable, the others would also likely remain quite vulnerable.
I was talking to risk analyst Manji Cheto in London.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
Welcome back to the programme. At least 15 people have been killed and scores others wounded when gunmen stormed a government college in northern Nigeria's main city of Kano on Wednesday. The attackers fired on fleeing students and set off an explosion, according to a military official. By the time of this broadcast, no one had claimed responsibility, but the finger of blame will likely be pointed towards Boko Haram. The Islamists have stepped up attacks on civilians following a military offensive which began last year. DW correspondent Alamin Mohammed is in northern Nigeria and has been telling me more on the tragic incident.
Actually, there was an report in Kano that some gunmen, unknown gunmen, suspected to be Boko Haram members, attacked students and workers at the Federal College of Education in Kofar Kabuga area of the Kano city. So many people fled because at the beginning there was an explosion at around 2 o'clock local time, that is 13 hours GMT. There was no official commission confirmation from the police and the local authorities, but honestly, there are a lot of casualties, as reports indicate.
Alamin, was the explosion set off by a suicide bomber or was it detonated by one of the attackers?
It was reported that it was a suicide bomber at the beginning. Then there were six gunmen, according to one student who explained the situation to the journalist. The six gunmen were shooting sporadically, and before they started shooting, those students experienced a very loud explosion, and it was not clear whether it is a suicide bombing or it was detonated, but somebody was saying it was a suicide bomber because he saw somebody that explode within the area.
And how has the military or the police force responded to this attack?
There is no any official confirmation, as we are talking to you now, from the police and military and the federal government or the Kano state government.
Kano has been hit by several suicide bombers, particularly female suicide bombers, which have mostly targeted educational institutions. Is there a particular reason for that?
You know, if it is Boko Haram that confirm attack that place, you know, the Boko Haram are against Western education. They say Western education is sin. And previously in their own messages, they warned that they are going to attack schools and other educational institutions belonging to the government and the private sector.
So
I think maybe that is why they are targeting or they are attacking schools, because that is their aim.
How come then that these institutions are not secured even after such incidents in the past?
You know, there are many institutions. There are a lot of institutions, primary school, secondary school, and post-secondary school. There are many. Sincerely speaking, there are some that were provided with the security, but there are many to the extent that that security will not be enough for them to stop the attackers. And, you know, the style of Boko Haram, when they are going to attack, they go there plainly without knowing they were the ones. They will just sneak into the area and attack.
Alamin Mohammed in northern Nigeria. And still ahead, a South African novelist talks about homophobia. You're listening to DW's Africa Link from Bonn, Germany.
Behind the headlines.
If you're not South African, the name Thuli Madonsela might not mean much to you. However, the South African public protector is seen by most residents as the moral conscience of the country. But now she has come under strong verbal attacks from the ruling ANC. This comes after Madonsela found that President Jacob Zuma and his family had benefited unduly from security upgrades at his Nkandla rural homestead. By going behind the headlines, Subri Govenda filed this story.
It is common cause that in the name of security, government built for the president and his family in his private residence a visitor center, a cattle crawl, a chicken run, a swimming pool, and an amphitheater, among others. The president and his family clearly benefited from this.
It's observations like these about the nearly 250 million rand upgrades at President Jacob Zuma's in Kandla homestead that have earned Thuli Madonsela brickbats and condemnations from leaders and ordinary members of the ruling ANC. 52-year-old Madonsela was born in the township of Soweto in Johannesburg to working-class parents came to prominence in 2009 after she was appointed public protector by President Zuma. A qualified lawyer, she previously worked for several trade unions as a legal advisor and also for several government departments since 1994. Since her appointment as public protector, she has received praise and support for her investigations into maladministration, corruption, and other malpractices in several government departments, local governments, and by government officials and leaders. Among those whom she has exposed for corrupt practices are a former chief of the South African Police, Becky Kehler, the chief operations officer of the state broadcaster SABC, Shlaudi Motsoeneng, and the chairperson of the Independent Elections Commission, IEC, Ms. Pansy Takula. But the ruling ANC now wants her out and has embarked on a highly abusive campaign sparked by her exposures relating to the upgrades of President Zuma's Inkandla homestead. The Secretary General of the ruling ANC, Gwede Mantashe, and the Deputy Minister of Defense and Military Veterans, Kebi Mapotswe, are among the top ANC leaders who unleashed their fury on Madonsela.
The public protector must get out of the political space, leave us as political parties to fight it out, sort ourselves out.
Not in exile. You'd identify a person by his or her actions that this one is an enemy agent. So her actions in that office of undermining any institutions, she thinks she's God.
In yet another verbal attack this past weekend, a member of parliament and top leader of the ANC's alliance partner, the South African Communist Party, Buti Manemela, called on Madonsela not to think that she was above reproach. He was addressing a group of supporters in the town of Port Elizabeth.
That as much as we respect and have to protect public institutions such as the Office of the Public Protector, it must be repeated over and over again that Advocate Thuli Madonsela is not God. Thuli Madonsela hasi modimo wa rona. It does not mean that everything that she says is right, is 100% correct.
But Madonsela has plenty of supporters of her own. Political scientists, constitutional law experts, and ordinary members of the public say that the public protector is merely doing her job and should be congratulated for exposing maladministration and corruption. Dr. Zakhele Ndlovu is a senior political scientist based at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban.
I think it's totally uncalled for. I think that most of these people who have been attacking her are just, you know, trying to please the president. I think deep down they know that she is someone who is doing her job, who is not willing to back down. She takes her job very, very seriously.
Ordinary South Africans are also concerned that the ANC leaders have gone too far in their attacks on Madonsela.
My observation is that as far as I'm concerned, she has done a sterling job in terms of giving credibility to the Office of the Public Protector. So on that one, I think she has done exceptionally well.
I think that people they're nervous because she's investigating what she's supposed to investigate, and it's unfortunate that it is the person that she's actually investigated, it's the president, and people are just scared, I guess.
That report was compiled by Subri Govender. Let's now move to Germany, where the 14th edition of the International Literature Festival is going on in Berlin. Authors from all over the world are presenting their works, and amongst them is the young South African writer Sonwabiso Ngcoa. He presented his latest book titled In the Search of Happiness. It talks about homophobia and xenophobia in South Africa. Christiane Vieira caught up with him, and her report is now presented by Azizat Sani.
30-year-old author Sonwabiso Ngcoa looks happy as he begins to read excerpts from his latest book, In the Search for Happiness. But as he gets to the heart of the matter of his book, the look on his face begins to change.
On the 23rd of July in the year 2012, in the township of Nyanga, a man, heterosexual male, kicked down the door of Pumeza Nkolonzi's house and shot her 3 times in front of her mother and her little niece. He killed her because she's a lesbian. And after hearing that, I said, no, no, no.
In the Search for Happiness is a story of Nana, a young girl who lives in a township in Cape Town and falls in love with her girlfriend from Zimbabwe.
Is it fair to look at a person who does not necessarily speak the same language as you, who has a different shade of skin color, to look at them and already decide that they are bad, just because they don't come from within the borders of South Africa?
A Dutch author, mentor of Unguwa, Loes van Dijk, defines the situation regarding homosexuals in South Africa as extremely controversial. If the Constitution says no one is allowed to discriminate one on the ground of sexual orientation, statistics show 500 girls are raped every day in the country. Many of them are victims of the so-called corrective rape.
It has been coined by many black heterosexual men who said, if we rape a woman, we teach her to become a so-called normal woman. It's a horrible practice happening where it does not even end many times in rape, it many times ends in murder, in the so-called education of them by heterosexual men, which was sexual abuse and sexual rape.
That's something young South African author Swambisi Unguwa is not proud of.
It's embarrassing for me to live in a society where people are prevented to reach their full happiness, where people are forced to live behind a veil of secrecy because they don't know who to trust. They don't know. I refuse to live in a society like that, and I would like for it to change, and to change pretty soon.
For that change to happen, there must be dialogue, he believes.
I certainly expect people who are not necessarily in the sexual minority groups to also ask themselves, what am I doing about the type of society that I want to live in? What role are people who are not necessarily homosexual, what role are they playing to make a society better for everyone?
That's why Van Dijk considers the literature work of Swambisi Unguwa as a unique contribution to South African development.
He is raising his voice to question rituals which are creating very unstable relationships between men and women, where the men are still oppressing in most times the woman. And this kind of new approach is very courageous, and he has been criticized heavily as he has been praised.
Since the beginning of the festival, ordinary Berliners in all of the city's districts will be reading from literary works of different authors participating.
That report was written by Christiane Vieira in Berlin.
Opinion.
For this week's opinion, let's return to our top story, which is the global response to the Ebola crisis. The US is sending 3,000 soldiers, the EU increasing its contribution, but most of it is going to Liberia. And as we heard from the Sierra Leonean activist, all the three affected countries need help.
They should not forget Sierra Leone. I hear a lot of the presenters and the doctors and the CDCs making the plans, and the higher numbers were being allocated to Liberia. And we have similar cases in Sierra Leone. So the situation where we want them to understand that it's not only Liberia, but it's also in Sierra Leone. And of course, definitely Guinea.
Sierra Leonean activist Ishmael Alfred Charles, and his remarks brings us to this question. Should the leaders of Guinea and Sierra Leone emulate Liberia's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to attract more international attention to the Ebola crisis? Send us your say either by text message to +491609575910 or an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, a letter to AfricaLink, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany.
From Cairo to Cape Town, Africa Link, covering the continent.
And as always, before we go, here's a recap of our main stories. The World Bank has warned of a catastrophic economic impact as a result of the Ebola crisis in West Africa. At least 15 people have been killed when gunmen attacked a government college in Kano, northern Nigeria. We've also been hearing about increasing verbal attacks on South Africa's public protector, Thuli Madonsela. And there we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Hope you join me same time tomorrow. And until then, I'm Crispin Mwakideu. Stay hopeful, stay alive.